Can we trust the historicity of the Christmas story and the Gospels in general? To discuss this now is Dr. Paul Meyer, a first-rate historian, professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University, and a best-selling author. And I'm so glad to have him back on the program. Dr. Meyer, welcome back.
Good to be back with you, Jerry.
All right. For Vocal Point, I'm Jerry Newcomb, and let's get started. Can we trust the Gospels in general? And the reason I even ask is because at Christmas time and Easter, it seems that a lot of times the networks will show specials, and they'll have all these scholars, and they have all the PhDs and so forth. And basically, they leave you with a lot of questions in implying that we really can't trust Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that we cannot.
Well, it's unfortunate. I think they're very unbalanced, the media are, in terms of always bringing up the sensationalizing higher critics who come along and say, no, that's what we used to believe, but this is what really happened. This attitude is overdone, overblown, and I find enormous historicity in so many aspects of the Nativity account. I can't give you a word-by-word description of the Annunciation to Mary by the angel Gabriel? Of course not. Only she and the angel were around. But nevertheless, she has certainly told it to Luke correctly, I'm sure. And so even these supernatural details, none of them violate the known surrounding history of the time.
Well, let's take the example. You mentioned the Annunciation. Here you're referring to the virgin birth, the doctrine of the virgin birth, that Jesus would be born by the Virgin Mary, but there would be no earthly father. As you, I'm sure you'd be the first to say, historians can't prove that one way or another. But I think it's important to point out that, in many ways, that's a very critical doctrine within Christianity.
Well, it certainly is. I mean, you deny the virgin birth, and in many ways, you're denying so much of the almost even the historicity of Jesus, because the rest of his earthly life is reported by those same Gospels. And so don't doubt the one part and say the other part's accurate.
Okay, now let's talk about the virgin birth, though, just historically, okay? First of all, it's my understanding that those who did not like Jesus accused him of being essentially of illegitimate origin.
Well, indeed, the opinions vary all over the board. You've got the claim that indeed she was ravished by a Roman soldier named Ben Panthera, and Panthera is near Parthenos, Greek for virgin, and that's how, again, she got the virgin name. All these fanciful ideas really have no basis in reality whatever. They've been attacking Jesus now for the past 2,000 years. It's kind of been open fire on him. There's nothing new here in terms of the latest critics. They're very unfair, however, using false arguments. The whole school of Rudolf Bultmann, you remember that one, in the mid-50s, 2050s, and 1950s, I should say, on the demythologizing of the Gospels. The only way people can believe today is you cut out all the miraculous items, and they grew up by a long tradition of oral passage of the information. It doesn't work. There's no way that you can have a long tradition of these things gathering additional embellishments through the decades. It doesn't work. The Gospels have to have been written earlier rather than later. That's the good news of New Testament research recently. There's no time for mythologizing to develop over a long period of time. The first documents, as you well know, were written not the Gospels, but the epistles of Paul, writing the Corinthians, 19 and a half years after the first Easter. I mean, this is pretty close proximity to the events themselves. And so all these arguments the critics used to use, we had to unlearn a lot of that stuff.
Unfortunately, though, I think some of that is still circulating around sources. You mentioned Rudolf Bultmann, who took the Gospels and demythologized them. In other words, took out the miracles, if you will. He was a direct teacher. One of his direct disciples was Helmut Kester, who has been teaching at Harvard. And in fact, I worked on a program with Dr. Kennedy, and you were in it, but I also interviewed Helmut Kester in that same program. And here at Harvard, which was originally, of course, founded for Christian purposes, by Christians, etc., they promote essentially unbelief, unfortunately, when it comes to Jesus.
They certainly do. You know, Helmut Kester is an interesting guy. You know, he has trouble with the real Gospels, but he falls in absolute thrall and in love with the Gnostic Gospels. Go figure that one. These incredible documents that are only parodies, only derivatives from the original Gospels of the New Testament, written later, much later than the events they claim to report. Those are the ones that these people now say probably should have been included in Scripture in the beginning rather than the four Gospels we know. This is ridiculous. And, of course, as you know, the best answer to anybody who has trouble with the true Gospels is read the ones that never made the final cut, namely the Gnostic Gospels. This is where you get all the rampant miracle stories, rampant mythology. And I just can't understand the logic of these people turning their back on the very sober historical recitation in scriptures and then going for these ridiculous false gospels instead. It boggles my mind. Kester's one of them.
Yeah, one skeptic that I spoke with, John Dominic Carson, said when it comes to the virgin birth, listen, Christians don't have a market on this. They said that Caesar was born of a virgin.
Well, not quite, but...
He was the son of God. I think that's how he said it.
Augustus, yeah. Augustus Caesar. I'm interested. I'm fascinated to hear that you interviewed the Irish leprechaun, as I call him, John Dominic Carson, an amazing guy, you know, who never found a heresy he couldn't wrap his arms around in love. And he always had this cute little Irish accent, you know, and that's the reason that the media loved him on television, whatever else. Remember he used to drop these one-liner bombs against Christianity? Things like, Jesus' body wasn't buried in Joseph's tomb. Dogs ate his bones. You know, things like that.
Yeah.
He's a little more muted lately, and I think in many ways you have others taking over his role as chief critic. But and somebody told me also that they knew the man personally, and he was very wistful over the loss of his faith. Mm. He said, you know, he still wishes he could be a Christian. That's pathetic.
Hmm. And it was very nice, by the way, and so was Helmut Kester, but they're wrong, obviously, in their theology and in their history. But let's go back to the core of what he's saying, is that it's not unique for Christianity to claim that their founder is the son of God. Here, Caesar Augustus, it's said about him, too. So how do we say, well, one is historical and the other is mythological?
Well, you bring up an interesting point here, Jerry, and that is a little malaise called what I love to call parallelomania. That is, in order to discredit the Gospels or prove that they're not bringing us something fresh, they go back to anything in the ancient world which smacks of any parallels to Christianity. The mystery religions, for example, of the Near East, those who have saviors dying and rising again. And what they do is, they take remote possible parallels and turn them into an absolute accurate carbon copy or Xerox copy of what happened, and that's where Christianity got the idea. The differences between what is claimed in the New Testament and these mystery gospels is enormous, and they always overdo the parallels. There's a little tweaking of the evidence so that it looks more parallel than it is. And generally, a lot of people pick up on that, as you well know, including one of the worst books ever written. That was called The Pagan Jesus by a Canadian author. And here was his statement. Jesus or Jesus sounds like Isis in ancient Egypt. And in fact, many scholars say, this fellow claims, that Isis is where Jesus got the whole concept. According to ancient Egyptian records 20,000 years ago, this is when it happened. And of course, right there, the man's flaunting his ignorance. 20,000 years ago, there was no Egypt. The art of writing for records wasn't invented till 4,000 B.C. And so it goes. And a lot of people will jaw, will drop, and they'll say, oh, and they'll realize how pathetically wrong this information is from the get-go.
Hmm. Yeah, the dying and resurrecting God. By the way, it's my understanding that when they talked about Isis or Isis in the God, you know, the dying and resurrecting God, they were talking about, number one, the day itself, where you have the sunrise, but then you have the sunset, then the sun rises again the next day. But then also there's winter and spring. Same basic phenomenon. In other words, as part of explaining
Greek, yeah.
nature. But when we talk about Jesus dying and rising from the dead, we're talking about things that happen, you know, one particular April. One scholar says 30 AD, another scholar says 33 AD, but we're still talking about something that happened, you know, on the Passover, on Friday, that he died and he rose on Sunday, etc. I mean, in time, space,
absolutely,
and history.
Absolutely, yeah, right. There's no question about that. And you have a real historical context with this particular biography. People like Jesus interacting with real people that we know from Greco-Roman history and Hebrew backgrounds. These are real situations. And then, as one aspect of that life, sure, died and rose again, but they claim that this is his whole biography. Well, no, it isn't. Whereas the case of these other mythical deities who die and rise again, you have they're born in mythology, and the whole experience is mythological by way of context. And so this looks like more mythology, and it is toward the end. In the case of Jesus, it's only one event that happened at the end of a very historical life, entered into by contact with real people in real places at a real time in history.
Now, the guy that was the founder or the key man in the Jesus seminar, who wrote the book Honest to Jesus or something like that, Robert Funk. Okay, he said, look, anybody that's looked through a telescope or looked through a microscope, in other words, post-scientific revolution, cannot possibly accept the Gospels as they are because of the miracles, the supernatural.
Well, that's what Boltzmann said, yeah.
And your comment to that?
Well, Ed, the man simply doesn't know what he's talking about. You know, and to be sure, when I heard the critics and read their stuff, I took them seriously, and I went back and I double-checked everything they were claiming, and they love to make these general sweeping comments without noticing all the details of the overlaps, the points of tangency, the bridges that can be built between the sacred and the secular. They're all over the place. So, you know, you finally come with the conclusion that this sacred history is the same as secular, factual records of the past. It's absolutely the same thing. Even though we try to say it's sacred and one's secular, nevertheless, it's only in terms of the thematic matter, not in terms of the way the research is conducted or the results. And, you know, time and again, well, just for openers, there are 50 names in the Old Testament which are both in the Old Testament and also well-known in secular history. There are 37 names in the New Testament that are well-known in the New Testament and well-known also in secular history.
When you say names, are you talking about names of people or names of places?
Names of people only.
Oh, okay.
Personality names. Oh, the place names are all over the place. Also,
oh, wow.
You bet. And this is a demonstration right there that the writers of Scripture, when they're writing history, now let's remember again, the Bible is not all history. Some of it's praises, some hymns, it's hymnology, it's a prayer book, it's wise sayings and this kind of thing. But where you have the past tense of narrative prose, he did, they went, and so forth, there you find enormous correlation between the biblical record and the secular record. And I've been kind of a specialist in that overlap through the years. I've just had more fun beating the bushes of the ancient world and pointing out how beautifully these things land on the other side. They're very historical. And sometimes in the secular history, we get even more details about a biblical account than in the Bible. I like that one.
Yeah, so when we watch these specials or we happen to see anything like this, or if there's a news magazine or something and it says, well, the Gospels aren't really historical, basically you're saying, listen, there's another side to this, and look for yourself and you'll see the Gospels are right after all.
Well, there's not only another side to it, there's a true side, and that what they've just said is falsity. No question about it. Yeah, yeah. And again, I think people, of course, usually stay by the last thing they heard or saw on television, and very often it is very unbalanced. The media are, I regret to say. They don't give even time to both sides, and they ought to, because there's a neat debate that could be raging if we had true representatives of the liberal cause, or the way-out cause, and the more conservative, traditional cause. And again, I'm a member of the second group, and I find again and again that ancient historians are far more friendly to the biblical record and regard it more highly than religious historians. Those who are theologians, they're the ones attacking Scripture. It's just an amazing reversal of roles here you wouldn't believe.
Hmm. Paul Meyer, thank you so much for being with us. Merry Christmas to you. Any particular book you want to mention by name, any of yours?
Try the Holy Bible.
Yeah, the Holy Bible. All right. Well, that's not by you, but that's the one to read. All right. God bless you.
Merry Christmas to you too, Jerry.
Merry Christmas now. All right. Thank you, sir. God bless. Bye-bye.